You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Susan L. Meisner.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a great show lined up for you today. Before we get started, I'd like to thank some sponsors for making the show possible. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, her new short story, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2, a sequel to A Superhero's Duty. Daniel Spires reveals to his team and Icarus that someone has been mass abducting the children of modern heroes and villains around the world. Icarus searches for answers while dealing with the physical aftermath of his encounter with Hellstorm. His powers are fading, and a compromised hero may cost him his life. This is an excellent new series from Patricia Gillum. There's going to be more coming soon. Stay tuned for it. Get in on the series while it's unfolding. Patricia Gillum, World Gone Red, Heroes of Corvus, Book 2. I'd also like to thank Richard Fox and his Ember War Saga. Guys, if you love science fiction the way I do, you must read the Ember War Saga. 9 books with several spinoffs, lots of great stuff going on in the Ember War. This one, and if you love audio, let me tell you, Luke Daniels narrates the audio for this series, and it is absolutely amazing. We're going to be talking about the Ember War Saga more in coming episodes, but go check it out on Amazon, The Ember War Saga by Richard Fox. Now on to our great show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Susan Meisner on the show with me today. She has a phenomenal new book called The Last Year of the War, and this book really took me by surprise, Susan. I'm really anxious to talk about it, so welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get to talk about all that good stuff, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Wow, that's a great question. I think it's so embedded in who I am that I actually cannot recall when I knew I wanted to be a writer. I think for some writers, it's so wrapped up in our DNA that we just discover that we already are one. And I think probably when I was in second grade, that's my that's the memory I have, although I believe there was something before then. But I had a great teacher who gave me a little journal to write down my stories in, and I still have that little journal. And I don't recall her giving that little red book to anyone else that day in school. And so to me, that meant that she saw something in me that girl's never playing with the plate. You know, the toys in the room, she's always at her desk writing, but I don't have any remembrance of that. I just know that I came home that day with that little red journal and that I was the only one who did.
I love those stories. There's something about that early encouragement from an adult, a teacher, a parent, that, you know, there are some really dark, lonely days in a writer's life, and that simple act of kindness that someone showed early on sticks with a kid throughout their whole life. And, you know, that the teacher may remember that or not, but I know you'll always remember that.
Definitely. I feel like that teacher, and I had another teacher in high school, both of those educators, I think, had pivotal roles in my becoming a writer. And the one teacher, I was not unable to reconnect with her before she passed away, but that English teacher, he and I have coffee every couple of months, even though he just turned 90. But it's important for him to know the influence he had on my life.
Oh, that is amazing. That is amazing. Susan, were you a bookish kid? Did you read a lot?
So my parents always had books in the house. My dad was a technical writer, and he majored in English. And my mom and I still share books. So books were always on the shelves in our house. We always had a library card, my sisters and I. And books were always under the Christmas tree. So I feel like it was probably inevitable that I would be a reader because we had books in the house. And then, of course, since I already had this itch to write, the fact that I had been a reader first, I think, really nourished me as a writer.
Your dad being a technical writer, how do you think just being around him and seeing him work, his craft, had an effect on you?
Well, I think it helped me see that there are many different ways to communicate. And so he was communicating words on a level that meant that he was like helping a company understand what they do and giving them communication tools to, you know, disseminate that information. And then, of course, you know, with me, I was writing poems and stories. It was a very different kind of communication, but it was still a person having the tools to be able to communicate information or stories or something to an audience. And so we feel like givers. Writers, I think, feel like givers because we are putting something down in words and giving it out to people who need to hear it or should hear it or must hear it.
I love that analogy. That's the writer as giver that really kind of gets down to the essence of it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. I think so, too.
So you had a second teacher in high school who encouraged you. Did you go to college to study writing?
When I graduated from high school, I had this mistaken notion that writing would be my hobby. It's my hobby. It's my therapy at the end of the day. I didn't think of it as something I could do as a career. I thought, well, if I make writing my career, I'll grow to hate it because everyone lives for the weekend and they hate Mondays. And I just didn't want writing to be a thing where I wanted Friday to get here and I didn't want the weekend to end. And I've since learned that you can't absolutely do what you love as your job and not grow to hate it. And it doesn't mean it's not hard work sometimes, but you can still love it. In fact, you're probably happiest when you're working at what you love. It took me a little while to figure that out, and so I did not major in English or creative writing, and I ended up not doing anything with my writing until I was in my 30s when I finally got a job at a newspaper and realized, oh my gosh, I'm in my lane. I should have been here the whole time. I can do this every day and get a paycheck, and it doesn't feel like labor that I live the weekend for.
I think that's a fairly common fear that some people have, that this thing, I love it so much, and if I make it my career, I'm going to grow to hate it. How? Because not every writing experience is just all daisies and sunshine and all of that. Sometimes the writing is hard and the characters don't want to behave, and you sit down and you just don't feel like it. On those days, how do you gin up the excitement again, or how do you deal with the days where it does feel like work?
Well, sometimes I have to remember that I have a deadline. You know, I signed my name to a contract, and actually that helps me on those days where I feel like, oh, I've got nothing. And I feel like if you wait for the muse to show up, some days you're just, it's just you. And so you can't rely on this notion that, oh, I'm not feeling it, or the muse isn't here today. I think creativity, sometimes you just need to sit down and just start writing. And it's like turning on the tap. You know, sometimes you want the hot water, and you turn on the tap, and all you're getting is cold water, and it takes forever for the hot water to finally get there. But you have to turn the water on first and wait for it. And so when you're sitting down to write, go ahead and start writing when you feel like all you're writing is cold water. The good stuff will come as you're writing. But if you don't sit down and write, you're not going to get anything. And you can't edit nothing. You can only edit what's there. Even if it's terrible, at least it's there and you've got something to work with.
Exactly. So you're working at the newspaper and you realize that that maybe you've missed your calling. How does that translate to writing fiction? What was the first project or the first idea that came to you that you knew that you were going to see this to the end and this was going to be a thing?
Well, actually, I think what it was, no, I know this is what it was. My grandfather died when I was 42, and he was like every kid's dream of a grandpa. And he was 84 when he passed. Yeah, you know what I mean then. And so I was exactly half his age when he died, and I realized, okay, my life is half over, relatively speaking, and I haven't written a novel, and I knew I wanted to, but I was at the paper. It was a 50-hour-a-week job. It was very intense. I had children in sports, and I kept telling myself, I'm too busy. I don't have time to even try. And so what I realized was that if I really want to give it a go, I'm going to probably have to make some changes, like give something up. And it was the job. It was the job at the paper, really. And I just realized that I would rather live with rejection than regret. I didn't want to come to the end of my life regretting that I'd never, ever tried to write a book, and I had always wanted to. And so I think it was my grandfather's death that kind of just prodded me to realize, okay, in some respects, your life is half over. Are you ever going to give it a try? And I'm so glad I took the risk, because even though it was fearful, thinking, well, what if nobody wants it? I'm glad I decided, well, I want to give it a try anyway, because it was life defining for me. You know, I've never looked back, and I've written 20 books since then. So sometimes the thing you fear the most, you need to go for it, because the fear is actually worse than the process of doing the thing that you fear, you know?
Right, right. So 20 books. What was that first idea? What was that first book that came out of that experience?
Yeah, that book is no longer in print. It is available on Kindle. It's called Why the Sky is Blue, and it's just about a woman who ends up she's assaulted, and she ends up pregnant, and she has no memory of it because she was severely wounded during the process. So I don't have to deal with all the ugliness of that. But she's married and has two kids, and the husband is like, we cannot raise this child. And so they give the child up for adoption. She ends up keeping it and gives the child up. And so it's the process of, you know, what does it mean to be a parent? What does it mean to sacrifice? You know, what does it mean to hold on to love when you feel like you can't? So it's a very complex look at, you know, what it means to be a mother, really. And so, and I guess I wanted to tell that story because I'm a mom. And even though that never happened to me, thank God, I just know what it is to love your unborn child and how to keep that love when you're not able to keep the child.
Mm. That's a powerful story. When you finished it and published it and started finding an audience for that, that had to be validation for the thing that you had been holding inside for so long, that now people were seeing it, reading it. Did you start getting feedback from readers, and did that solidify your desire to move forward?
It definitely gave me the affirmation I needed to keep at it. And plus, the publisher was a small publishing house, but they really liked my style, and they gave me, you know, they opened the door for me, really. Even though I didn't stay with them, I moved on, and now I'm with, you know, Penguin. They, you know, that little house kind of saw my potential, and I really didn't know a whole lot because I hadn't majored in creative writing. I kind of had a lot to learn, but because it is my lane, I think I learned quickly how to make a story better and better and better with each one. And so I'm very grateful for that start.
Looking over your catalog of work, there's a thread that runs through a lot of your stories, it looks like, and that's the thread of hard decisions and complex human interaction. What is it about the drama of humanity, the things that make us wrestle with deep issues? And your new book is no different. What is it about wrestling with those weighty things that that you love digging into?
Well, I think as readers who read fiction, and I know there are a lot of people out there that's how they end their day, or that's how they relax, or that's how they escape. They want to experience something, and a meaningful story will transport you into that story's world, and you get to try out what it's like to be the hero, or what it's like to be fearful, or what it's like to find resolve you didn't know you had. And so I think a really good book will do that for you. And so we learn things about ourselves when we read a novel, because we come away with it with something. Either, well, I'm really glad I read that, or I need to talk to somebody about this book. And that's, I think that's why there are book clubs. And it's a club. It's a club to talk about a book. It's because books have this power, I think, to change us or inspire us or intrigue us, and we want to talk about them. I think books had that unique power then to kind of weave their way into the way we think and the way we feel, and you know, we're compelled to talk about it with somebody.
Right. Since coming to Penguin, you have been writing historical fiction. What is it about historical fiction that you love so much?
I think for me, historical fiction is transportive. Like I said a couple seconds ago, historical fiction brings you into a world that really existed. It's real, and you're experiencing it through the lives of perhaps fictional characters. At least my characters are always fictional, but the world they inhabit is real. And so when you read it, my goal as your host is to bring you into that real world. It's like a ticket to visit a time and place that no longer there, and really only historical fiction can do that, because there is no time machine. We can't go back in time except in the pages of a historical novel.
Right. We talk a lot on the show about the great role that historical fiction is playing, especially right now as we mm-hmm. get farther and farther away from historical events. World War II is very popular mm-hmm. right now, and I think that because a lot of those people that lived during that time, that fought the war, that kept the mm-hmm. home front, we're losing all those people, and
yeah.
in losing them, we're losing their stories. And the more distance we get between now and an historical event, the more it gets reduced to bullet points, as we're teaching these things. What kind of responsibility do you feel to preserve these stories, the feeling of the time, the struggles that people were going through, and do you is it intimidating to carry that?
For me, it's not so much intimidating as it is. I am uniquely gifted to make sure the stories get told before we lose their eyewitnesses. So, storytellers and journalists, anybody involved in the literary world, including you, it's like we have this opportunity to tell stories while the eyewitnesses are still here. And who else can do that but people who write or do podcasts or record, or, if you're involved in any kind of media, you have an ability to keep history alive for as long as we can. And when we lose the witnesses, then we have to rely on what they left us. And in many cases, they leave us biographies, autobiographies, literary remains, diaries, things like that. And so as long as we who have the chance and the ability, to write things down or record things or put things in archives, then there'll be something for other people, future generations, to find and read and listen to. And so it's great, really, that there are people involved in media, because we're the ones who leave behind the remains of the lives that are, that are no longer with us.
Right. When you're beginning a new historical fiction book, and the new book is The Last Year of the War, it's on mm-hmm. sale everywhere when people are hearing this. When you're dealing with a story like this, and we'll get into kind of what the hook of the story is in a minute, but this is a really unique historical event that this book is based around. Mm-hmm. When a story starts forming for you, how does it begin? Is it a historical fact that you stumble upon? This is interesting. Mm-hmm. Is it a character? Is it a premise? What usually comes to you first?
Yeah, usually it is. I come across a historical event that hasn't had a whole lot of light thrown on it, which means that there's a story waiting to happen there because it hasn't been told yet. And so I respond to events and settings where ordinary people like you and me are thrust into extraordinary circumstances, and they have to find a way to survive and hold on to who they are. That to me is always story worthy. And with this particular book, I found out something I didn't know about something that really happened to real people. And so then I was able to imagine a fictional person experiencing that world and finding out what it meant. Like, what kind of impact does that event have on humanity? Because it's always going to have some kind of impact. And what was it? And then so I imagine a story in a world that really existed but no longer.
So what was the historical event that's kind of triggered this and set off the chain of events that the story comes from?
Yeah, well, I found out, I was talking with a friend, an acquaintance, that he was reading a book, and it was about the fact that German Americans were also interned in the U.S. during the war, and that some of those German American internees were repatriated. They were traded back to their home country for American POWs and civilians stuck behind enemy lines. I had never heard that. I had known about Japanese Americans being interned. I live in California. I live in San Diego, in fact, and everybody up and down the West Coast who was of German American ancestry was either relocated or interned. And so I knew about that, but I had never heard the same thing happen to a number of German Americans, 10,400 actually, and that some were repatriated. They were sent back to Germany the last year of the war. And so that to me is a story about humanity. Ordinary people being thrust into extraordinary circumstances. And because I had never read a novel about it, I thought, well, it's a story that should be told, can be told, because it hasn't been told yet.
I had never heard that story. That was when I started reading the book, I was kind of floored. That's not something that gets talked about. When you discover something like that, and it's obviously not in the mainstream, I think a lot of people will be surprised at what they learn. Where do you begin to start getting information about it and start, getting down to the nitty gritty of it?
Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of these untold World War II stories, someone has done the hard work of finding out what really happened, and they've written it down in nonfiction form. And so I read a book. It was a really good book, actually. It's called The Train to Crystal City. It's by Jan Jarboe Russell. And it is it's the historical, the nonfiction account of German Americans who were sent to a particular internment camp in Crystal City, Texas. And of the 4,000 who were sent there, more than 800 were sent on one repatriation trip, and then a few others on another. So almost 2,000 were repatriated to Germany from this particular internment camp. And so I read that book and went down the rabbit hole, if you will, and started researching other things that I found out in that book, and was able to connect with some former internees who were children at the time, because most of their parents have passed. But these families who came to Crystal City, usually it was the dad who might have been arrested for there were no charges. They were never charged with a war crime, but there was something about them that the FBI, the War Department, felt like it was a security risk to have them out and about. So they'd be arrested and turned, and at Crystal City, you could have your family join you. So that part was great, that you could have your family join you from wherever they lived.
Right.
But they had to voluntarily give up their freedom to do that. And then in doing so, you knew that there was a high possibility you'd be repatriated. And with my family, my fictional family, the dad in the story, he's a great guy. He's no threat, but he can't prove his loyalty. And he really hopes that will not happen to them, that they will not be sent back. But of course, that's the story of this tale that I'm telling, is that they were repatriated. And so it's a story about identity, really.
Well, we all know that the best way to talk about a complex issue and to really get people to think about it is to couch that in story. And we can talk about this issue because you've created these phenomenal characters in the setting, and you drop us right into it. And and you do that through the perspective of Elise, this 14-year-old girl. How did you decide whose perspective to tell the story from? After you'd gathered all the information, you kind of knew how the process was going to work. How do you then start creating fictional characters and decide to put them on the path that you do?
Right. Well, for me, picking Elise as the protagonist, she's the one telling the story. For her, there was the most catastrophic change. There was the most that she had to respond to at kind of a tender age. Most people, when they're in their teenage years, are forging their identity. Because you're on the cusp of your adult years. You're on the cusp of being the person you're going to be, like, almost the rest of your life. And so for her to be suddenly not your average American teenager, which is what she is, but that's what she's dealing with, the feeling that she's not, because, you know, she's taken from her home. They're interned in this camp in Southwest Texas, and suddenly she's the daughter of German American parents. She's a German girl, and she meets a Japanese girl in the camp. They become best friends, and this other girl is like her best friend, and they have so much in common, except that the other girl is Japanese. Yeah, but that's not how they feel. They feel like two American teenagers who just have dreams about their future. And so I feel like having a character like that, young, who is, you know, on the edge of her adult life, made for a very compelling story. And we also see this character at the end of her life in this book, because she's looking back and telling the reader, this is what it was like to feel like your identity is being taken from you. And she's just found out she has Alzheimer's. So again, you know, as she's entering her last years, she's feeling like, this is what it was like, you know, when I was a young teenager, and my identity was being peeled away from me, and there was nothing I could do about it. And how did I hold on to who I was? because you have to. You know, you have to find a way to hold on to who you are when it feels like you're being, you know, your identity is being torn from you.
Right. Man, what a powerful story. When you're writing historical fiction like this, the writing process, do you gather all of the information ahead of time, kind of educate yourself on it, and then just start writing the story out of that? Do you mm-hmm. do a detailed outline? What is your preparation process for writing a book like this?
Yeah, I'm an outliner by nature, so I do my research up front, a lot of it, so that I feel like I can put together an outline. It would be hard for me to outline a book if I don't feel like I have a handle on the historicity of it, like all aspects of that history. And so for me, it's like shopping and buying everything. And I don't really know exactly what I'm going to be making, so I need it all. And after I've filled my shelves, so to speak, then I can sit down and outline based on what I know really happened. And once I've written the outline, that allows me to start the writing. I feel like I'm equipped to start, but I rarely look at that outline again as I'm writing, because the writing process is rather intuitive and it just starts to take over, which is great. But if I lose my way, if I'm feeling like I don't know, I forgot where I wanted to go here, I always have my outline to go back and look at. But I don't spend a lot of time revisiting the outline as I'm writing. It's just there as a map to remind me this is where I wanted to go.
Excellent. What are you working on now, Susan?
So the book I'm working on now doesn't have a title yet. Sometimes the title emerges after I'm done, actually, with the book. And so it's a work in progress. I've only got about 35,000 words, but it's set in San Francisco in 1906. So I'm going to use the earthquake as it's going to show up in the book, but it's not an earthquake book. You know, it's not a book about a natural disaster. It's a book about three women whose lives converge on the day of the quake, and it's because of the quake that they actually meet each other. And for them, it's going to be a really good thing that the earthquake came, because for most people living in San Francisco then, it was catastrophic, that quake and the fires that followed. But for these three women who each kind of have their own little history, it's going to be really good, because it's going to cover something that they need covered. And so they're probably the only three people in San Francisco that are glad the earthquake came.
That's going to be fantastic.
Thanks.
Susan, after 20 books, how has your writing process changed? Do you still approach it the same way in the beginning? Have you learned some things about yourself and about the writing process that have helped hone your skills?
I feel like with each book that I write, I want to set the bar a little higher each time. And so in some ways, writing hasn't gotten any easier 20 books later. You know, you'd think, well, after 20 books, you know exactly what you're doing. But I feel like I raise the bar with each new book, and yet I start each book the same way, with nothing. And so it's a little daunting to have the bar seem so high each time. And I guess maybe it's a good thing. It keeps me on my edge. It keeps me from falling into, like, I don't know, a sense of mediocrity when it comes to this. And so even though I feel like I've grown as a writer, my skills as a writer have improved, I'm sure, I still start feeling like the task is too big and the height is too high. And so I'm able to kind of, I guess, feel like it's like I'm starting for the first time, you know, and maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Sometimes those butterflies are part of the exciting part.
Right,
means something,
right.
It means something amazing is just around the corner.
Right, exactly.
Susan, if people are just learning about you and your work, is there a place where mm-hmm. they can find you online, dig into your back catalog,
sure.
follow you, and all that good stuff?
Yeah. Yeah, I have a website. It's just SusanLMeisner.com. You can also find me at SusanMeisner.com. They both lead to the same place. So that's my website, and I have a blog that I write on mostly on Fridays about books, so they can find me on my blog every week on a Friday. And then I'm on Facebook too. My author page is where I spend my most time, so it's just my name, Susan Meisner. And I post a lot of fun stuff on my Facebook page, not just about my books, but about other people's books, articles about writing in general and living and life and all of that. And then I'm on Instagram and also on Twitter. So whatever social media platform people enjoy the most, I probably have a spot there you can find me.
Awesome. And we'll put links to all that in the show notes at hankgarner.com. Great. The book is The Last Year of the War, a story about World War II that I think will surprise a lot of people. And I highly recommend it. We're going to send everybody to see you. Susan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creepshow? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was cueing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped Sunkist and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up! Oh, idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church, determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out. "No," Buddy whined. "Not on movie night."
Daddy went to the window. "It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, scary blackout? Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet."
"Cool. And candles."
Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary, "Huh!" sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
"What's going on?"
he whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.